customers give credit. So whenever we had trouble, we would look up there and say, but how did they do it for the Tori code? And so, but anyway, so then I will talk about the threshold for quantum LDPC codes in the present, when the distance is a power of the block size. Then I will talk about the maximum likelihood decoding and how it relates to the non-local spin glasses. And then I'll, you know, mention some open problems. And so, well, first of all, statement is, I'm going to suppose that the decoding threshold exists. And so I will have to explain what the decoding threshold is. And so I will always assume that you have errors which are local on the qubits, and they happen with probability P. So that's, you know. And so, and the statement is that you can find the code which would be large enough that can correct all errors with success probability P going to one. Now, I will be talking about infinite codes for code families. And so in the case of the Tori code, it's a very simple proposition how to construct a family, infinite family of Tori codes. You just take dimensions bigger and bigger and bigger while keeping the structure of the code the same. It doesn't always work like that, but basically the working definition will be very simple. So suppose you pick up randomly from some collection of codes, making bigger and bigger codes, and then for this collection, we'll establish the threshold this way. So if there is a limit, so if there is a limit that when a system goes infinite, that below certain error probability, you can correct all errors with probability one, that you will say you are below threshold, so this is decodable phase. And then eventually at some point, some codes will fail, and so in this limit, and so we'll say this is above the threshold. So this is very vague definition, but stick with me, and I think it's good enough. Now, so one example would be, suppose you have a code family where this distance, relative distance is finite. Okay, so here, this is distance of the code over n. And so basically, it is known, so then when the block size n goes to bigger and bigger, the distance goes bigger. And what we know is that any two errors which involve fewer than distance over two qubits can be correct, can be distinguished. And so that means in the limit of very large systems, you will have, you know, the distribution of errors will be picked at p times n. And so for such a family, the threshold for sure will be bigger or equal than half the relative distance. And now, of course, the actual value will depend on the decoding algorithm as well. So this is just the best possible, or assuming that you are using the distance to decode. But anyway, question is that when we started thinking about it, can we generalize the result for the Tori codes where it was the threshold was interpreted as a phase transition in the Ising model? Can we interpret this decoding transition as a phase transition? So now, what this graph, what this slide is intended to show is just quantum families of codes with finite relative distance exist. Okay, and so there is Gilbert Varshamov bound, which basically would take a random code. And for example, if you take random CSS code, meaning that you take a couple of random binary matrices, impose the orthogonality condition, meaning rows of one matrix are orthogonal to rows of the other condition, and then you do some counting, and then you discover that for sure there are codes below this green line. And so here, this is the code rate, meaning how many qubits, what is the relative number of encoded qubits divided by the block size, and this is the relative distance again. And so the, below this line, there are codes. Now, why is this is not useful for in the case, why is this not very useful? Because the quantum codes that you get tend to have very long stabilizer generators, and there is no way to reduce them down. So if you're an experimentalist trying to measure a quantum operator that involves 100 qubits sitting randomly somewhere in the place, you know, if I suggest it to an experimentalist, they will throw me out, right? because nobody can do this measurement. And so what you want to do in order to be able to even do quantum measurement, you have to have objects that you can measure to be smaller. And so this GV bound is not really useful. And so let's go back then and analyze what happens to the surface codes, because surface codes we know have distance which scales like square root of n, square root of the block size. And so technically they have zero relative distance. And then how does it happen that they still have a decoding transition which is finite, and actually decoding transition that is on the upper margin of whatever what is considered to be possible? And so this is the picture of the Torrey code. And so so black dots and blue dots and red dots are qubits. And then this circle represents one of the stabilizer generators of the Z type. And so you can shift it anywhere. And then this is the parity check, meaning the product of these Pauli Z operators on all these qubits should come to one. And then the product of Pauli X operators on these four qubits, which form a cross, also should form one. And so the code space is the eigenspace of all of this Pauli operators. And for simplicity, I will assume periodic boundary condition versions of this. Okay, so now what are the detectable errors? Suppose you have an X-type error happening on this qubit, and this is this little circle. And then basically immediately, so that qubit is flipped. And so immediately these two checks will become unhappy. So the left check and the right check, so there are two checks immediately that will become unhappy, and so we can detect this error. Now, if you have several errors happening in a chain, you see what happens, the plaquettes, they hit chains in the middle, they always share two qubits which are in error. And so this error is a product of Pauli X and this operator here, here, and here. And so then the check that the line goes through, except for the edges, these checks will remain happy because there is always an even number of operators that anti-commute by topology. And so the errors that form closed loops will be undetectable. And then there are good and bad undetectable errors. So good or trivial undetectable errors, and these are just loops that are topologically trivial, and these you can construct out of product of this B plus operators, right? So this plus here, plus here, plus here, plus here, you will get this loop. And so basically any loop you can construct this way, this is just the geometry. And then bad undetectable errors, these are which you cannot construct out of the product of the stabilizer generators. And these would be topologically non-trivial loops that wrap around the system. And so for the minimum size of the bad undetectable error is the distance of the code. And in this case, it's the side of the square, which is proportional to the square root of n. Now, so the relative distance scales like square root of n, why do you have a finite decoding threshold? And so in the original paper, now this was the first ever paper on rigorous analysis of quantum LDPC codes. And so in the original, they have at least two arguments. I may be missing some, Andy. but they have at least two arguments. So one was, let us just count these topological and non-trivial chains. And the counting argument, what works like this. Suppose I want to look at undetectable errors. And so I want to start with some point X and construct this chain. And so first time, and I want the line without crossings, right? So any error, any undetectable error would be a chain of some sort. And so I want to know how many chains starting with X. And the way it works, I just start, and then on the first step, I can go in one of the four dimensions. But once I started, I can continue only going along one, two, three directions, but not backward, because I want a line without crossings. And so the upper bound is very simple. This is self-avoiding walks. And so this is 3p to the power of d with a prefactor that I will drop. And so this is, and so then if this quantity 3p is smaller than one, then asymptotically, this goes to zero. And so as long as your distance code is big enough, the chances to encounter this long chain are nil. And so you are done. And so if you want error correction, you have to be more subtle. But basic argument is you want to look at the chains which are filled with errors up to a half. And so, again, this is 3 to the d is the number of self-avoiding walks. And then there is this binomial summation, which you can upper bound by this quantity. And then, again, you get a bound. And so the statement is that you don't have undetectable errors. You don't have uncorrectable errors on average. So with very small probability, of course, you can have an error. But with probability 1, for long enough codes, you will be able to correct all errors. So now, the other argument is regarding the mapping to the Ising model. And the way it works, let me sort of try to explain. So here, I have to introduce the check nodes. And so let's say I flip this. I have an X error on this qubit. And so as we saw, both of these nodes will become unhappy, right? But remember, what we are able to do, we are able to this configuration, we are able to add stabilizer generators. And so what the stabilizer, let me see. So let me just think what happens if you add a stabilizer generator. So one way to think about it, so I multiply all of these 4 qubits by z, and so I can view this multiplication. So I, whatever state there was, I multiply these 4. I guess the trouble is that I introduced the wrong kind of errors. But anyway, so what you can think about it, that you introduced error here, 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 and here. But now you can think of it as flipping of some effective spin. So if you put spins in the center of the plaquette, then if you flip the spins and you imagine having this simple Ising model. So if you flip this spin, then this bond, this bond, this bond, and this bond will suddenly change the sign. And so now the probability, you know, when we're counting error probability, we're counting a number of flip spins. And so in this picture, basically, you replace the sort of total probability of having, you know, error, which is this error or this error plus some number of this stabilizer generators. You replace it by a partition function of the Ising model. And then once you establish this mapping, then, So once you establish this mapping, then you get the partition function of bond disordered Ising model on some lattice, and then basically you identify the maximum likelihood decoding transition and the phase transition along the Nishimori line. And now for the 2D model that was known, for 3 and so this establishes the existence of the finite decoding threshold for the Tori code. So now, of course, Tori codes encode just, you know, a few qubits. And so now let us look at some more general codes. And one thing that, you know, is known is the theorem by Sergey Bravo, Terhal, and I don't remember if there are any other authors. But basically, if you arrange qubits on 2 dimensions, then there is an maximum limit on the number of qubits that you encode times the square of the distance, and that product has to be approximately equal n, or order of n. And so if distance gets bigger, then you sacrifice the number of encoded qubits, etc. And so you can easily satisfy this inequality just by taking plane with some holes in it and counting the number of qubits. Now, so what general quantum LDPC codes do, you remove the requirement of locality. So you say there are stabilizer generators where each involves just a few qubits, but of course you remove this requirement of locality. And then the ansatz that I started, my work on the quantum LDPC codes, actually it's very simple. So you construct this two binary matrices, which rows of the matrix GX define the generators of X type and row stabilizer generators of X types, and then rows of GZ define stabilizer generators of the Z type. And so you construct them as two block matrices. So E is identity matrix, each one is some binary matrix, and this is the same matrix transposed. And so if you multiply, and this is a Kronecker product, and so if you multiply GX times GZ transposed, on the first block you will have H2 times H1, and then on the second block you will have H2 times H1, and so when you add the mod 2 to identical object, will give you zero. And so, and then you can establish the parameters of the codes, and you discover that you can actually construct with, because classical LDPC codes exist, and there are many of them, and so you can construct code families with finite rate, kind of k over n, and the distance that scales like square root of n, just like for the Tori codes. And so these are, operators that can be measured. Moreover, you can measure them in parallel, meaning you can measure them efficiently, and so hopefully it will work. And of course, you have this non-locality, and we still have to figure out how to work with these, but sort of a big question is, you can actually come up with a spin model map, but the question is, does this system has a transition, right? So you have to understand, in the case of the Eisen codes, it was very easy because, of the Tori codes, it was very easy because you just could count the chains. The chains determined the structure of the bad errors. And so you can analyze those and basically be done. But now you don't actually know what the properties of this matrix are. So all you know is the matrices are sparse, that they have very few ones compared to zeros. And so, and you can hope for some distance that diverges, that is required, of course. But what can you say about the threshold? And let me reiterate about this statement about the finite bound. So if you have finite d over 2, right? If you have finite d over n, the number of errors, the typical number of errors that happens is p times the total number of qubits. So when you scale it up, right, and the distance is just, let's say, a square root of n, then the typical size of the errors will be incredibly bigger than the distance of the code. And question is, how can you possibly hope to correct all of those errors if there are so many? Okay. And the answer is actually a simple argument is percolation. And so let us think, let's take this code, and this is one of the hypergraph product codes. So the stabilizer generator of the Z type involves 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 qubits. And then you translate it over all sides of this lattice, and that would be one example of the hypergraph product codes. Okay, and so let us take error probability, which is small. And so, and here I'm only looking at these X errors, and I will continue this talk talking about specifically CSS codes just to make my life easier. And so X errors are marked with red. And then let us connect all of the errors that are talking to the same stabilizer generators. Let me see. If I translate this blue figure to the left one step, then I will discover that these qubits actually involve the same stabilizer generator. And so I connect them. So that's the prescription for building connected clusters. So whenever two errors can be connected, like these two errors, I can translate this to the right and down. And so these errors are going to be connected. Then these two errors will be connected. And then this and this is also connected because I can connect across the boundary conditions, right? And so each disconnected cluster can be corrected independently without affecting syndrome or without affecting other clusters. That's the key observation, right? And so if the error can be separated into pieces which are of small weight, then I can correct each piece individually. And this also proves the distance of the code, you know, the bad uncorrectable errors that determine the distance must actually be connected clusters. Because if you say, let's say the distance is determined by two disconnected clusters, you can actually reduce one of them because each of them separately will give you zero stabilizer. Each of them separately will commute with all stabilizer generators because they never involve the same stabilizer generator. Okay, and so you can connect one of them. And then next step is just percolation theory. So below percolation limit, you have exponential distribution of the cluster sizes. And so it has exponentially small tail. And so even though you have the number of clusters that are sort of scale with n, you can still, maximum cluster size will grow logarithmically with n. But if the distance grows faster than a logarithm, let's say a power law, then you can detect all clusters. Yes?
Can you reiterate how you construct the clusters?
Right. So if, speaking about the Tanner graph, so whenever you have two information bits that talk to the same check, these are connected. Okay, and so if they both have error on them, then they are in the same cluster. That's the construction. Okay, and the statement is, there is for the codes where the weight of the row of the parity check matrix and the weight of the column of the parity check matrix are both limited. For these codes, the percolation threshold is finite, and moreover, there is a limit below which you are guaranteed to have this exponential distribution. And so for small enough, in this case, X error probability, you will have this situation where you can detect all errors independently, and then you work a little bit harder and count the number of, errors that sort of fill each cluster up to a half, and then you get this estimate where JZ is the product of weight, column weight times the row weight minus one. Yes?
Can you just go back one slide, please?
Sure. Page up.
You're specifically working with the hypergraph product for this.
Yeah, but no, it doesn't. It applies generally.
But I mean the constant. So there's an implicit statement about a big O in here about the cluster size and the percolation model, right?
Right.
And that constant is not universal. It depends on the details.
Which one? Which? Yeah, okay, so the way you can do it, you see, let's say you start growing the cluster, right? And so the best, you know, whenever you have loops, you come back and so they don't help you to grow the cluster. So the best possible way, you say, I will replace this tree growth situation by a cluster where I can never have loops. And so that gives me the biggest possible clusters. And also, so this is the worst case scenarios as far as clusters are concerned. And so by doing this, we can actually, because for the trees, you can tell a lot about the trees, you can actually put the exact upper bound, and this is the theorem.
I guess I'm just worried that if the Tanner graph has good expansion properties.
Yeah. So all you need is for this to work is that both the check and information nodes have for limited weight. All you need for that.
But I think the answer to this question was on the next slide. It's the Z parameter.
Right. So you see, the critical threshold is bigger or equal than 1 over Z squared. And then there is this pesky factor of 2e, where e is the base of natural logarithms. So this is actually, you know, a very loose bound, but it's bound nevertheless. And so recently we actually improved it quite a bit, you know, still work in progress. So basically you can drop the weight of the check node, the weight of the information nodes, just have L minus 1 squared, where gamma is 1.2. And the way you do it, you just build, not look at all of the clusters that are bound, but all of the clusters that potentially can satisfy the checks. And these are, you know, many fewer, because every time you encounter a bad check, you have to correct it anyway. And so it doesn't matter which, you know, you choose first. And so there are L minus one up to L minus one positions in each check. And so if you have cluster of weight W, then the number of such clusters is L minus one to the W. So this is comes very close to the toric code estimate, which is 3 to the power of W.
On the previous slide, you said logarithmic distance was good enough, but in the theory, you just said power.
Well, it does say the threshold also exists with distance scaling logarithmically. Oh, but basically there, you have to worry about the coefficients, because there is a coefficient, and, you know, one logarithm has to be bigger than the other, and so you have to worry.
Sufficiently large
constant. Right, right. Okay. Okay, now let's go to the decoding transition. And so again, infinite family of stabilizer LDPC codes, and we know that they have a finite decoding transition. For example, you pick all codes of limited weight, and that would mean that, you know, there is certain PC so that for all of the codes, you have decoding probability one below this PC, or and then not so above this. And so now what I'm going to do, I'm going to do some calculation. And basically, so we are looking at the error syndrome, right? And again, I'm looking only on the errors of X of Z type. Well, okay, here I'm looking at the errors of Z type. And so my stabilizer generators are given by X only operators. And so the syndrome can be written, you know, the syndromes are the you know, so non-zero bit in the syndrome means that corresponding stabilizer generator anti-commutes with the error. And in terms of the binary matrix language, that means that the corresponding row of this matrix GX has to have an odd overlap with the error. And that means that this product mod 2 will be 1. Okay, so now, so that GX and GZ, and you know, are orthogonal matrices. And so if you have an error which is proportional to a combination of rows of GZ, that would be a trivial error. And moreover, if the two errors, just like David told us, if the two errors differ by some stabilizer, some member of the stabilizer group, these are equivalent and we call them degenerate errors. Okay. And basic statement is that you don't care which error in the degeneracy class you pick. And so when you look at the error correction, you just have to look at the probability of a given degeneracy class. And so if you know probability of error E, then you have to sum over all of the degeneracy classes to come up with the error, which is exactly in the same coset or in the same degeneracy class with error E. So this is the total probability that this is the total probability to have error with the same properties of exactly identical with E. Okay, now, however, these are not the same, not all of the errors with the same syndrome, because you can also add the code words. And so the code words are denoted by C. And so these code words are not linear combination of the row matrix of GZ, but they are, so they are linearly independent of the rows of GZ, but they are also orthogonal to GX. And so a basic question for decoding a quantum code, you have to calculate these probabilities. And let's say you encode K different qubits. And in this case, there will be 2 to the K different code words that you have to compare. And so there will be 2 to the K different topological sectors you will have to compare. And for each of them, you have to calculate this sum, right? And so clearly for finite rate code where K goes to infinity, this is exponentially expensive. But nevertheless, let's suppose we can do it. And what would be the implications? Can we understand this decoding problem from that case? The advantage of this analysis is that I'm looking at maximum likelihood. So I'm saying, what is the maximum likely error? I know perfectly what the error probabilities are. Given the syndrome, what is the most likely error? This is what I will be doing. So this is presumably the best possible way to do the to correct errors. And so the way I am going to approach it is to try to construct spin model that corresponds to this transition. So you see, I have a binary sum over this rows of the, you know, which rows to include, which rows of the matrix GX to include. And now I'm going to rewrite this binary sum as some spin model. And this is a standard way to do it. It is always possible to do. And so this is the model, kind of models that we come up. You know, at first we thought, well, we invented these models. But then, of course, we looked at this paper by Wegner in 1971 and discovered that most general models have been constructed by Wegner. And so you have a connection collection of, well, first of all, you have a binary matrix theta. And it has elements of 0 and 1. And so B correspond to the columns. And so each column of the matrix correspond to a bond. And so whenever you have a 1 in this column, you pick that spin. So the spins actually correspond to the rows of this matrix. So whenever you have theta JB equals to 1, then that spin is in this row. And then unlike the simple Ising model that we just heard about, this have multi-spin interactions. So every sort of bit from this matrix, which is non-zero, will be picked up by this road, and so it will be a product of several spins. Okay, and then in addition, you flip the bond or not depending on the value of the error, E sub B, and then you calculate the sum over all values of spin equals plus or minus, and I denote this using the spin glass notations. Okay, and so the probability that I just discussed on the previous slide, so this is the sum of the probability over all rows of the matrix GZ, E plus alpha GZ, right? So this probability turns out to be this partition function with error E. For theta, I just choose GC, and then the temperature here is related to this error probability P, and it happens to be exactly the Nishimori temperature. So it works independently of, well, as long as you have this error model, then it definitely works. Okay, so this is a huge simplification. There is a lot you can tell about this model because the interesting decoding thing happens exactly at the Nishimori temperature. And then, so each multi-spin bond corresponds to a column of GX. Now, each non-zero bit of this representative error is a flipped bond, which means antiferromagnetic as opposed to regular ferromagnetic bonds. And then you have decoding transition at the Nishimori line. And then each code word, it's actually a defect. So in the case of the Ising model, the code words correspond to domain walls, either horizontal, vertical, or a combination of those. But in this case, you don't really have a geometry, so we call them post-topological defects. So there are extended big defects, but nevertheless, they are sort of, they share some of the properties with the topological defects. And then the probability to obtain the given syndrome is you just have to sum over all 2 to the k code words, including the 0. And so this is the probability. OK, now, what is the situation where you can do optimal decoding? Well, it's very simple. So suppose PE is the actual error that happened. And so P0, one of the terms here, is the probability that it happened, right? But now, the syndrome you get with this bigger probability, which is the sum over all different possible different defects, right? But now, in fact, if you obtain the syndrome, of course, you pick the biggest one, but then the other errors could have happened as well. And so if you think a little bit, you discover that this ratio, P0 divided by the sum, is actually the probability of correct decoding. So if you want perfect decoding, and this is what we're attaining to, right? You want this 0 to be 1, meaning this sum has to be dominated by just one term. It doesn't have to be P0. The error that you could guess originally could be anything. But as long as this sum is dominated by just one term, you can do the decoding perfectly. Okay. And so And so this way, I argued that you could do get spin models, and so the models can work for any stabilizer codes. Any error model, you could write this, although I'm not sure whether it or not there will be some, you know, how nice these models will be. This we're still in process of doing. Now, this is all only useful for LDPC codes, because if you have a gazillion of bits per bond, right? If there are many, many, many bits coupled all to each other on this multi-qubit interaction, then there is not much that you can simulate, not much you can tell about these models. And then there are typically non-local, although, of course, there are Tori codes and other codes where there are local. Now, in general, again, there is no local order parameter. So the Ising model is excellent in the case that you can just find this very simple order parameter, which is the average of the spin. But in general, you could have models, for example, with 3-bit coupling, and so there will be up or down. Also, you get some gauge models. So there are a huge variety of non-local models. And in general, you can have, as long as these rows of this matrix are non-mutually linearly independent, you get a non-degenerate ground state. Okay. And nevertheless, these models, as long as you have a decoding transition in this family of codes, the models will have a phase transition from the ordered decodable phase at small p and t to a disordered phase at p and t large. And then this is the this is the ratio that you have to worry about. And so this is the way we define this ordered state. So you have the ratio of partition functions, one without any defects, the other summing over all of the defects, and then averaged over all of the errors. It has to be one. This ratio has to be one asymptotically for very large systems. Now, what you can tell out of this? Yes.
I think I missed another
thing. Z0 is what I previously called P. And so you see P is basically decoding probability, but now I extend it because I let temperature go its own way and P. And so I changed, switched and flipped the notation, and I'm calling now Z for partition function.
Why
zero? Z0, okay. So here I'm averaging, so E are errors that actually have happened.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And so I want most likely error.
Yeah,
so in fact, you know, I'm simplifying a little bit because there is a separate phase which we think are unlikely where it's some ZC max. So in truth should be Z max over Z total. Okay. Right. But on the Nishimori line, it's okay. Away from the Nishimori line, there could be complications. Okay. And so the results, summary. And so this ordered phase was, you know, P0 divided by this huge sum, right? Now, so each of this sum is basically a partition function. And you see there are exponentially many terms in the denominator. And so if this has to be one, so these all other guys should be exponentially small as well. And so first of all, just the free energy of a defect, which is this logarithm averaged over E, should be divergent. That's first statement. But moreover, you can define a line tension. So for each code word C, you find the, for each universality class, you find the minimal weight code word that is in the same degeneracy class. And so you call it the distance of this code word. And then this would be an analog of the line tension of the domain wall. So in the case of the Tori code, you can have a domain wall that wiggles like that, but the minimal domain wall would be straight line. And so similarly, horizontal wall. And so for each defect, you can find the minimal size of the defect, and that would be the distance. And so this is an analog of the line tension. And so in the ordered phase, which is when this ratio is one, you know, there are many, 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 many terms here, right? And then you can have a bound, so the average over all non-zero code words, so these are the rest of these guys, of this line tension should actually be bigger than RT times log 2, where R is the rate of the code, which is K over N. So for the Tori code, it's just bigger or equal than zero. So for the Tori code, line tension vanishes, you have a transition, there is no other way, right? But for this finite rate codes, you have another possibility. So you could have one of the code words lose the line tension. And that would be sort of, so you will have, you will go in the transition where you can decode some code words, but not the other ones. Or another probability that you have to jump. And this is would be a sort of a jump, which is determined by the entropy of the defect types. Because you have so many different defects, 2 to the k, that, you know, yeah. So if all of them remain finite, right, or roughly the same, then, you know, to violate this, you basically, yeah, anyway, so as long as it, you, all of them can remain finite, but yet you will still be outside of this decodable phase. And then you can basically take Nishimori theory of spin glasses and do the much of the derivation. So the energy is known exactly along this line. And this is the Nishimori line. And I'm now using these notations, which are common to the, you know, P is now the error probability, right? And then this is the multi-critical point, which is, okay, so there is a phase transition along the red line, right? And at this point, there is no singularity, so it better be multi-critical. So whatever the intersection of the Nishimori line with the phase transition line, that must be a multi-critical point because it's non-singular, and then specific heat is finite, exactly the same as in the general case. Now, sort of in addition, and I will talk, that would be my next slide, you know, even though there is no other parameter that you can define, there are still some spin correlation functions that you can introduce that actually will determine from which you can read off whether or not you have, you know, whether you are below transition or not. And so we call them indicator correlation functions. And for those spin correlation functions, again, Nishimori theory applies, and you can derive the same condition on the location of this phase boundary. So the multi-critical point is the top position, is the upper possible position for the ordered phase of this kind, where the maximum likelihood error is the error of, you know, most probable error. Yeah. And so the phase boundary can either go, and this is called decoding transition, right? So the phase boundary either go vertically or it bends down a little bit. And that's basically, that's sort of the results that you get from, you know. Now, why is this interesting? Let me first go, you know, why do we care? Well, important point is you can do a Monte Carlo simulation. You don't have to have a decoder. You get the code, you can do Monte Carlo simulation, and you can simulate the spin model, and you can tell very precisely what the threshold. You change the model of disorder, you can tell very precisely what's the threshold still. So you can analyze codes irrespective of decoders, right? So that's one thing. Second thing, you have your favorite decoder and you say for the Tori code, it gives you 7%. We know for the Tori code, the threshold is at 11. So that's the performance of your decoder. You fail on this last 4%, right? So experimentalists are trying to draw the threshold by making better qubits and sort of spending gazillion in their equipment, but now we are missing on just the theory part, and so we have to come closer. So in this case, you know this code give, you know, some other code would give you something else, and so this is the... Now, interestingly, the position of this multi-critical point for the simple codes that we tried, and these are all sort of simple periodic structures which generalize the Tori code. So there's technically these are not finite rate, but these are zero rate codes. For all of them, and which are the planar geometry, and so technically there are actually Tori equivalent to the Tori code. So for all of them, the threshold is about 10-11%. We didn't do many, you know, very careful estimates. Now, we understand that all of these models have exact duality. At least all of the models that we tried have exact duality, so actually self-duality in the absence of disorder. And so this point is actually 2.3, which is the Cramer's point. This is exactly the same as for this regular Ising model from duality. As long as there is only one transition, it must be there. Whether it's first order or second order doesn't matter. You can still get it from duality. And then this multi-critical point is very close to 11% again. And so basically this phase diagram for all of the simple models we tried look very much the same. Now, not so if you add the errors in the syndrome, which Alexei will be talking next in the next talk. Okay, but now let's talk about these indicator correlation functions. And so, again, I come back to the notations of this Wegener model. And so I have these multi-spin bonds. And in principle, you could say, yeah, you could say I'm picking this, 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 and this spin, right? Now, question is, will I get zero or not, right? Well, you know, in the Ising model, if you are in the paramagnetic phase, right, if you don't, you know, and you, if you have a finite size system in the Ising model, one bond, one spin will always average to zero if you do a true true average, right? And so, but now in this case, what is the general condition? And this is spelled out in the Wegener's paper. So basically the spins you have to pick, they have to be a product of the same bonds. So this is the necessary and sufficient condition for the spin correlation function to be non-trivial. So in the case of the regular Ising model, you have bonds which involve two spins. And so even number of spins will have non-zero correlations, odd number of spins will have zero correlations in the finite system, right? And then, so this is the correlation function, and then you divide by Z, by partition function, which is sum of the same Boltzmann weights without the spin part. And now this is minus one to the EB. So this is exactly the term that I discussed. So each error corresponds to a flipped bond. And then I also divide, so this is for a given defect C, right? So, it's included in the error. And then the total is this sum. So I have just the correlation function, just this part, and then divided by Z total. And then I have this minus one factor, which is necessary. And so I define these two correlation functions. And then the bonds are defined as usual, and spins are plus minus one. And so by definition, these correlation functions, both of them satisfy this inequality that they are, you know, must be smaller or equal to one in any configuration by magnitude, right? Now, you can check that these are invariant under this transformation. So for the code words, you can add alpha, you know, generator of the Z matrix, rows of the Z matrix for the, and this is the same as is used here. And then for this magnetic charges, vector M, you know, which spins to include, you can add rows of the X matrix. Now, if I take M to satisfy this equation, so this is the code word in the dual. So C satisfy this equation, B satisfy this equation. Right, so if this is one of the dual code words, but B non-trivial still, meaning that you cannot, we will not make it zero. But anyway, so if you take M equals to B, then this correlation function actually, you know, each term here will be one, and so this correlation function will be one, but this correlation function will pick up this minus ones. And so if only one of the Z's is dominant, then basically you can use it to distinguish between which one is dominant. Okay, so let me repeat it. So the way it is constructed, right? So I have, so basically let's put all the Q's to be one. So ZC over Z total, right, is all sum up to one. And given the error, right, one of the C's could dominate or many of them could dominate, but basically it's a Fourier transform of these ratios. And so by taking different vectors M that satisfy this condition, by picking vectors M to be one of the dual code words, you can, and calculating these correlation functions, you can actually determine which of these Z's dominate. Okay, and so we used this property to establish, you know, theoretically this phase diagram. Okay, but question is, so summation here is hard because it involves summation over these code words, which are very heavy, right? Which each of them is very, very long. And so summation here is non-trivial, and you cannot really do a Monte Carlo simulation easily. But now can we get a simpler expression? And so here I will use the duality transformation. And so I go, you know, and this is again, Wegener invented, well, Kremerson, Vanier and Kremerson, Vanier invented it, right? But then Wegener wrote it down for the general case. And by the way, for the people who are specialists in the Decodian theory, this duality is nothing but the McWilliams identities. Okay, and so basically you have two orthogonal matrices, right? You have two orthogonal codes. So you have two binary, two matrices with rows orthogonal. And so the sum of the ranks is equal to the number of the columns of the, that's the condition for the Kramer's identity. And so you see in here, I'm summing over when I calculate this Q total, right? So I have contributions, which are my spins, which enter this partition function. And these are just rows of GZ, but I add summation over Cs, which are rows, again, orthogonal to the matrix GX. So the total summation involves all of the vectors that are orthogonal to the matrix GX. And this is exactly what enters the McWilliams identity. Okay, and so now then you get this tangent beta equals e to the minus tangent beta star. And so the statement is that the dual matrix has, you know, it has a similar partition function, right? Instead of the magnetic charge is now replaced by error. So you have to correlate, you have to calculate the correlation function of all of the bonds that, you know, previously had errors, okay? Now, the disorder is replaced. There is no disorder here, so this is zero. So this is a clean partition function, so there is no spin glass in here. Okay, so this is, so you just, you know, this is just a simple duality transformation. Now, I haven't, you know, simulated this yet, so we're still, no. And so let me show how it works for the Torrey code. So this is the Torrey code you saw, and let us suppose this is my error, right? Of course, this is the error that I identify, which is wrong, of course, because most likely the error would have been this bit and this bit instead of these 5 bits, right? Okay, and now let us try to calculate, so let us try to calculate, you know, write down what one of these partition functions. And so, well, first of all, this, so M is this vector M. Oh, here, it replaced the error. So these are the flip bonds. So basically, I can flip either all of the bonds in this line or flip all of the bonds in this line. It doesn't matter. And then I will simulate this Ising model. So the yellow triangles are, you know, the position of rows of GX. This is dual code. Now, the flipped bonds, these are, this is the line of flipped bonds. This corresponds to the dual code word. And then the bonds from E, the product of the bonds from the error, I will average. So I will average the product of this bond times this bond that wraps around, etc. And so in fact, there will be 1, 2, 3, 4 spins that enter the correlation function. And so the statement is, if I calculate this correlation function, the sign of this correlation function for the solution which has the main vol along this way or along that way, not all to the n, not all to the k, but just k domain vols configurations, I should be able to discover which error was right. So which topological class is the right topological class for this error? And so now this is yet work in progress, and you see this is, it could turn out to be hard because, yeah, I write this a minus one sign problem, but this is a potential applications, you know, how you can use what is well known and techniques which are well established in the theory of spin glasses and statistical mechanics, how you can get them back and actually gain some important insight in the theory of quantum error correction. Okay. Now, this takes me to the summary. Okay. So basic first statement is, all you have, you, if you have a quantum LTP, quantum stabilizer code, right, with limited weight generators and a distance that scales like a power law of the block size, then you have a finite threshold. Now, without the syndrome measurement errors, but for that, Alexei will talk about that system. Now, if you have any stabilizer code, the corresponding maximum likelihood decode corresponds to the multi-critical point along the Nishimori line in the associated spin models. And so this model are actually interesting because nobody cared to look at the spin glasses on some weird graphs, but there are interesting models. But the line tension is finite, average line tension is finite, so it shouldn't be that difficult to decode, but still we have these difficulties. But anyway, and then Monte Carlo simulation, you can establish threshold for a given code family independent of decoder. You can give absolute measure of decoder performance, and possibly you can use it to help with the decoding. So you identify one error representative and then gauge from the Monte Carlo simulation what, you know, which sector this error should be. And then there are many open questions, which is, of course, what this whole workshop is about.
And then I wouldn't say that these are relatively inexpensive simulations.
Which, well, it's relatively inexpensive simulation compared to the price of decoding. If decoding is exponential, then it's very expensive.
Okay, this kind of relative.
Yeah. No. We tried to simulate best we could do with sort of homemade methods was like 1% accuracy. Because, again, this is multi-critical point, so there is no sharp singularity in the... There is no sharp specific heat singularity, which is standard way to locate transitions. And so you have to look around and extrapolate. So there is still some work to be done. So it's not as trivial as I made it to appear. But thank you for the comment. Yes.
So I'm wondering if you think that the Monte Carlo could be exponentially slow for these simulations?
Well, look, so basically this dual version, let me go back to this original, yeah. So
yeah, so I understand that kind of the
right
checks are sparse and so on.
Right. So in the dual version, you have to compare the sign of two partition functions, uh-huh. And as long as the sign is, So you have to compare the sign of the two partition functions, but then it gets smaller and smaller as you get higher dual temperatures. And these dual temperatures have to be quite high. And so the value gets small, so you have positive and negative signs. So in the case of the usual Monte Carlo simulation, you add positive things all the time. And so this is why it's efficient. When you add positive and negative quantities, I don't know. So it could be that this could be done inexpensively. It could be that there will be a huge complexity just getting the numbers. That I don't know yet.
But just like getting a good sample of a space seems.
You have to flip. You know, you have to do multi. You know, some cluster bit flips, etc. So there are all sorts of tricks that have been developed that accelerate Monte Carlo simulations. I'm not really an expert. I'm learning this stuff. The answer is I don't really know. So the stuff that we tried was quite expensive, but not overly so. So it's definitely not exponential complexity.
Maybe just phrase my question another way. I mean, so if you were to compute the total partition function,
yeah,
this seems hard. Because you have to sum up the topological and equivalent classes.
Yeah, but remember, all you need to learn is the signature of signs, and the total partition function is actually always positive.
But I mean, you have to tunnel, like if you want to sample, to tunnel through, the minimum distance. So.
Correct. So what I'm saying, you don't really need to compute the total partition function, because all of those are positive.
Yeah, I understand. But yeah, I'm just questioning. I mean, it's, I don't think that, well, computing one of the ZC is any easier than the Z polynomial.
Why? Because you just, you, so you have some error pattern, you flip some additional bits, and that's, you know, your ZC. One of them is not hard. All of them is hard. All to the decay of them is hard.
But the number of ZCs is very large.
Right. So sure. this alternative method, you know, because we're actually using this string of, you know, correlation function, and we, you, you know, here it is easier to calculate because you don't have to compute all of them. You just compute some signatures, and that is a much sort of, you know, much smaller simulation.
But do you think it could happen that most of the logical operators have very high weight, so the total partition function somehow is dominated only by the few terms?
Yes.
Logical operators?
That's true. What would be the signature in this partition function? I don't know. So just as I said, you see, when these correlation functions we used in sort of theoretical constructions, it works beautifully. So we could establish the phase diagram. We just took the Nishimori theory and put it, and it worked nicely. Now this is in the domain. If we want to do numerics, the answer is I don't know. It's a potential. It's a possibility. If it works, beautiful. If it fails, well, this is just one of the other methods that failed for the degenerate LDPC codes for, as a decoder. Yes.
Okay, so you talking about a second order phase transition. Do you have anything?
Actually, no.
Order?
Actually, in the most models, the transition is first order.
Oh, okay.
So, mean field. If you try to do mean field theory of phase transitions, you get first order whenever you have more than two spins coupled. In reality, there are some examples of three-spin coupled, you still have second-order transition. There are sort of published spin models which involve three spins in along this direction and two spins along this direction, and so those have second-order phase transition. But tendency is the more the spins, you get first-order transition. Of course, first-order transition is easier to map because specific heat is diverging much faster. Remember, the specific heat is the sort of fluctuations of energy divided by the number of sites. And so if you have a finite difference between the two, finite difference of energy between the two sites, that means specific heat actually diverges quite rapidly. And I was trying to find this phase diagram here. So the statement is that out here, you have first order transition. Then as you approach this multi-critical point, it gets weaker and weaker and weaker. And at this point, of course, there is no factor, no singularity in the specific heat. And so you kind of gradually have a weaker and weaker first order transition. And actually, then it becomes harder to tell whether you suddenly have second order transitions or not. You have to do real more careful analysis than one would try.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.